talking about some joint work with Peter Shor, showing that a certain problem of estimating Jones polynomials is complete for the one clean qubit complexity class. So first I'll explain a little bit about Jones polynomials and their relation to knot theory, and then I'll explain a little bit about the one clean qubit model, and then just give a sketch of the proof of this completeness result. So a knot is a topological object. It's just an embedding of the circle into three-dimensional space. And more generally, a link is an embedding of any number of circles into three-dimensional space. And here's a few examples of some knots and links. This one here is called the unknot because it's just a loop. And this one, although it appears superficially different, it's considered to be an equivalent knot because you can just untwist it and it gets back to the unknot without ever passing the strands through each other or cutting them. Now here's an example of a knot that isn't equivalent to the unknot, and there's a simple example of a link. So one of the basic questions in knot theory is, given two knots, are they equivalent to each other? And although in these small examples it looks pretty easy, it turns out that if you allow large knots with many crossings, this becomes hard. And maybe the best studied example from a computational point of view is the problem of, you're given a knot and you want to determine whether it's equivalent to the unknot. And even showing that this was computable was very non-trivial, and that was finally achieved in 1968. And currently the best known, to my knowledge, the best known upper bound on the complexity of this problem is that it's contained in NP.
How is the knot described?
Okay, so I think it was Lagarayas and some collaborators. I don't remember exactly. Yeah. So it, for the purpose of quantum computation, we're going to describe these knots in terms of grades, and I'll get to that in a few slides.
But the equivalence, we have no idea whether that's computable or NP or anything.
I don't know whether it's contained in NP. I would be very surprised if it's uncomputable, but I don't know off the top of my head what the whether there are papers actually proving this.
Not going to be NP hard, or?
No, as far as I know, it's, all that's known is that it's contained in NP. So one way you can simplify this problem a little bit is, or at least make it discrete, is using a theorem that was proved in the early 20th century, which says that two knots are equivalent if and only if one can be transformed into the other by making some finite sequence of Rademeister moves, which are these three possible moves shown here. So this, in a way, reduces it to a discrete problem, but it still does not make it easy because it can take an exponentially large number of Rademeister moves to get from one knot to another.
Can we look at the previous slide real quick?
Yeah.
Okay. So if I imagine these things in three dimensions, then two there wasn't, I mean, you didn't do anything at all, right? But so how am I representing?
That's also true of one and three.
Yes.
Right. So the question, how are we representing these things?
Well, for now, you can think of these knots as being represented by two-dimensional diagrams. So you can say that it's really every crossing is going to be a point in a graph which has valence 4, and then it also has an additional piece of information there about which strand is crossing over the other one. That's one way of representing them, yeah.
Stepping back, so really you're supposed to think of them as, you know, curves in three dimensions, and they're equivalent if they're topologically equivalent in three dimensions, which is why none of these things do anything, right? Topologically speaking.
And I guess what I was trying to identify is what is the representation in which these transformations do something.
Okay.
Okay, so one tool in understanding equivalence of knots is knot invariance. And a knot invariant is just a function whose input is a knot, and it's designed so that if two knots are equivalent, then it should give the same value as output for both of those knots. And there, in general, there may be some knots which are inequivalent, but yet still give the same value. And a more powerful knot invariant is generally one which successfully distinguishes more knots. And the Jones polynomial is a especially powerful knot invariant, which was discovered in the 80s. And it distinguishes many knots, but it's sharp p hard to compute exactly. So here, without going into a detailed definition of the Jones polynomial yet, I'll just give a couple of examples of the Jones polynomial.
Calculating the polynomial itself or evaluating it at some particular value?
Well, there are a few values where it has some elementary interpretation. So if you, so it's a polynomial in a single variable. And if at certain values, like t equals minus 1, it'll have some interpretation of just the number of crossings or something trivial like that. But at most points, it actually, at those individual points, is still sharp p hard to compute. Yes. So there's an additional technical detail, which for the purpose of this talk will not actually be that important. But it is true that the Jones polynomial is actually a polynomial on oriented knots, so that or more generally on oriented links, so that for each of these circles you choose a direction. But for the unknot, the Jones polynomial is one. And here's the Jones polynomial of this knot. And in general, it's a polynomial in a single variable t. The exponents can also be half integers, but in these examples, they happen not to be. So now we get back to this question of how to describe knots on a computer. And the way that we're going to do this, which is most relevant for quantum computing, is actually in terms of braids. And so a braid is just, you can think of it as a set of pegs across the top and bottom, the same number of pegs. You have some strands that start at one at the top, wind around the other ones in some arbitrary way, and attach to one at the bottom. So the set of braids on n strands can be thought of as a group. The group operation is just concatenating the braids one on top of the other, connecting them at the bottom pegs to the top pegs. And this group is generated by the crossings of neighboring strands. So sigma I is the crossing of strand I and I plus 1. And then here's the inverse crossing where it just winds the other way. So if you can see that if you put these together, they'll cancel each other out. And then these relations for the group completely capture the topology of braids. This first relation just says that crossings on disjoint sets of strands commute with each other. This relation is a little less obvious, but actually, if you draw a picture of it, it's exactly equivalent to this Rademeister move right there. So the reason we bring in braids is because you can obtain links from braids. So here's an example of one braid. Now, if you have an even number of strands, then you can do something called the plait closure of the braid, where you just take each pair of neighboring strands across the top and bottom and connect them together. And then another closure is called the trace closure, where you connect from the bottoms to the top. And there's an old theorem about this, which says that any link can always be obtained as the trace closure of some braid. There always exists a braid such that by you retrieve the link by taking the trace closure. And as an easy corollary of this, you can see that the same is true for the plait closure. And the way you can see that is by transferring these return strands into the braid itself. So now you have the plait closure on a braid of twice as many strands. So because of Alexander's theorem, you now have you can describe links in terms of the discrete language of the braid group.
It looks like you've got the same braid with the two different closures, and you're saying that you get the same underlying...
Well, this is the flat closure. If you're considering not only these blue lines as part of the braid, but also these lines right here. So it's now a slightly more complicated. Yep. Yep. Okay. So now that we have specified how we're going to input the link into the quantum computer, we can start talking about the complexity of approximating the corresponding Jones polynomial. So it was shown originally from work by Friedman et al., and then further developed by Aharonov and collaborators, that a certain additive approximation to the Jones polynomial is of the Platt closure of a braid. Remember, that's this one with attaching neighboring strands, is BQP to complete to evaluate at values of t, which are kth roots of unity. So now the thing that we output from our algorithm, it's not a polynomial, it's a number. It's just the value of this polynomial at a particular point.
You skimmed over how exactly one figures out what the Jones polynomial is from the knot, the braid. I assume that was intentional. But
yes.
Is it really high order? Does it have exponentially terms?
No. It doesn't have exponentially many terms. It's just that the coefficients on those terms can be exponentially large, and it can be very difficult to count up and find out what those coefficients should be. Okay, so in this case, you get your answer. So here's like the true Jones polynomial, e to the... and then what you get is some number. And the difference between these is bounded by some constant, which is exponential in the number of strands. So this is an exponentially poor approximation. And the surprising thing about this is that it's hard to compute at all in some ways. But it turns out to be BQP hard. Yes.
Is that number exponentially large? It's because it's a linear number of bits.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Sorry.
Okay. So the BQP completeness is for the Platt closure. And for the trace closure, it was known that you could do the same approximation in BQP, but it was not known to be BQP hard. The question of how hard this problem is remained open. For all we knew, it could be doable in polynomial time. But the topic of my talk is that this problem is actually complete for the one clean qubit complexity class. So this means it's very unlikely to be doable classically in polynomial time and provides an exponential speed up by a one clean qubit computer. But it's also very unlikely to be BQP hard. So now I get to one clean qubit computers. So in a one clean qubit computer, you start with one qubit that's in a pure state, and the rest of the qubits are in the maximally mixed state. And this was introduced by Knill and Laflamme as a sort of idealized model of high entropy quantum computation, such as in NMR. And it may appear a little artificial to have to model high entropy by having one pure qubit and the rest maximally mixed. But actually, it's not so unreasonable, because using techniques such as algorithmic cooling, you can take general mixed states and convert them into a small number of essentially nearly pure qubits and the rest highly mixed. So from this model of computation, this is where you start with the one clean qubit initial state, and then you apply a polynomial-sized quantum circuit to that and do a measurement at the end on the single qubit. So this is the problems that you can solve this way form a complexity class called DQC1, and this class is believed to be strictly weaker than BQP, so it's not as strong as a full-blown quantum computer, but still capable of solving some things that are classically intractable. And another interesting thing about it is that it's not strictly stronger than, it's not believed to be strictly stronger than classical computation either. There are some problems you can solve on one clean qubit that you can't solve classically, and vice versa. I skipped over, but what you actually are allowed to do is you can think of this as an experiment, and you can run it polynomially many times, but always with the same starting state, and you can count how many times you get a certain output from your measurement.
The DQC1 computer.
Typically, at least in the
NMR
model,
we have
a classical computer which does that.
Yeah.
So, and also a classical computer that tells you kind of what you want to do, what your input should be.
Oh, you're objecting to it not being able to solve everything in P because you are sort of implicitly assuming a...
It's to say you have a classical computer plus you have...
An NMR machine.
Yeah, well
idealized.
Yeah.
Okay. There exists a formalization of this model where trace estimation of quantum circuits is a complete problem for it. And essentially for the purpose of this talk, we can consider trace estimation to be our model of one clean qubit, and everything else is going to be reductions to and from that. But we'll see that in a few slides. Okay, so now with this deterministic quantum computation one. NC1 stands for Nix class 1, but it's actually a logarithmic depth classical circuits. Okay, so now with this background in place, I can state the main result a little more precisely than in the title slide. So approximating the Jones polynomial of the trace closure of a braid is DQC1 complete at t equals minus e to the I 3 pi over 5. And so that means that this can be efficiently computed on a one clean qubit computer, and the problem of simulating a one clean qubit computer reduces to this. So I'm only aware of a few algorithms for one clean qubit computers that are thought to provide exponential speed up. The two other ones I'm aware of are trace estimation and approximating certain quadratically signed weight enumerators. So now I'll start to describe how the proof of this completeness actually works. So we're now coming back to the question of how to define the Jones polynomial. And there are different ways of doing this. And the one I'll describe is not necessarily the simplest one, but it is historically the first one, and also it's the one that's most useful for quantum computation. So there's a certain representation of the braid group such that the trace of the Jones representation of a given braid equals the Jones polynomial of its trace closure. So actually, it's technically a family of representations that depends on the parameter t. And a certain matrix element of the Jones representation gives the Jones polynomial of the plaque closure of that braid. So it turns out that for t being a root of unity, the Jones representation is unitary. And so because of this, you can get an approximate correspondence between quantum circuits and braids. For a given quantum circuit, it corresponds to a certain unitary, and it turns out that you can find a braid whose representation approximates that circuit, and vice versa. So here's an example of that from this paper here. People also study this in the context of topological quantum computation, and here's a braid that approximates this very simple quantum circuit to pretty high precision, I think, 1 × 10⁴. So the rough intuition for why the Platt closure should be BQP complete and the trace closure should be DQC1 complete is that, recall that the Jones polynomial of the Platt closure of a braid is a matrix element of the Jones representation, and finding a matrix element of a quantum circuit is BQP complete, whereas the Jones polynomial of the trace closure is the trace of a representation of the braid group, and the trace of a quantum circuit is complete for one clean qubit.
The renormalized trace of the unitary.
That's correct. And that's exactly where this approximation factor is going to arise from. Okay, so now I'll describe why trace estimation is. Yes?
Better to have two clean qubits than one clean qubit?
It's not. And we'll see that, I think, on the next slide.
This is the same model.
Okay.
So your approximation there,
yes.
What's an upper bound on V of U the IK itself? How big could V be?
The largest, I guess, is if you have this braid, then its representation is the identity. And then the trace of that is just the dimension of the space. So for k equals 5 that we're going to look at, the dimensions of these spaces are going to be Fibonacci numbers. I think on n strands, it's like the n plus 1 Fibonacci number or something like that.
Factorial.
That's what I mean. Also exponential.
I think it goes like phi to the n, where phi is the golden ratio.
Bound's not trivial, right? If V is also bounded by D to the N, then I can just always say N.
Right. This is, these numbers are both exponential in N, and they're fairly comparable, but the bound is not trivial, and maybe the strongest reason to believe the bound is not trivial is that we know this problem is computationally hard. So if you could just guess zero every time and always be right, then BQP is a pretty trivial complexity class.
Number is less than D. If D is bounded by something bigger than D to the N, then that bound is trivial. Okay. Oh no, sorry.
It might be actually the same exponent but with a different prefactor. I'm not sure if the I'd have to check that.
And increases or something.
Okay. So I'll now briefly describe the proof that a trace estimation is complete for DQC1. This was known prior to our work. And it basically comes from the Hadamard test. So you're probably familiar with the Hadamard test. You run this circuit, and you do this measurement, and the probability of getting the zero outcome here is proportional to the real part of the matrix element of the circuit with this input state. So now suppose instead of picking a particular input state, you choose it randomly uniformly at random from the 2 to the n bit strings, and put it in here. You sample a certain number of times, and average your result. It's going to be the average of these matrix elements, which is just the normalized trace. And this gives you the real part. If you input a 1 here instead of a 0, you get the imaginary part. So if you run this experiment some number of times with a 0, you can estimate the normalized trace to polynomial precision, and likewise for the imaginary part. So that shows that you can do trace estimation in one clean qubit. And next, we'll see why it's hard for one clean qubit. Let's see here. Sorry about that. Okay, so now we need to show that the problem of simulating a one clean qubit computer is reducible to trace estimation. So let's say you measure, in exactly as in this case, you measure the first qubit to see if it's in the zero state. That's the final step of your one clean qubit algorithm. So the probability that it will be in the zero state is the trace of the projector onto that state times the final state from your computation. The final state from your computation will just be this one clean qubit initial state, projector onto zero tensor with I density over 2 to the n, and then you conjugate that with your unitary, which is your quantum circuit. So if you just substitute this into there, you find that the probability of obtaining zero at the end of your process is proportional to the trace of this non-unitary operator that has these two projectors in there. So we just have to reduce this to the problem of finding the trace of a unitary, a quantum circuit. So it turns out that the trace of this non-unitary thing can be obtained up to a normalization constant by taking the trace of this circuit here. And the reason for that, so let me first say, this top line is this first qubit that has these projectors onto zero for it. And then here's the rest of the n qubits that our circuits act on. And these are two extra qubits that we're introducing. So now think of the trace as a sum of the diagonal matrix element for all the computational basis states. So if in your computational basis state, this bit is 1, then this controlled knot's going to flip this bit. And since this bit gets flipped, it's now orthogonal. So that matrix element's going to be 0. So you effectively project this qubit onto the 0 state. And then you do the same thing here for this other projector. And actually, this is how you can see that you don't gain more computational power by introducing 2 clean qubits or 3 clean qubits or even logarithmically many clean qubits, because you can effectively simulate them using this trick. So you can essentially add these projectors onto here to project onto only having the trace over states where the first few qubits are always 0. The penalty you pay is that you have this factor here of 1 over 2 to the number of times you've done this, and that messes up your approximation factor. So you can only do it up to logarithmically many clean qubits.
The first qubit onto 0, 0.
Yep.
But I'm just not seeing why that lets you effectively simulate another clean qubit.
Oh, well, because trace estimation is DQC1 complete. So trace for 2 clean qubits, this you have you could just, instead of the trace being the sum over all the states, you just sum only over the states where the first 1 qubit or 2 qubits take a certain value.
The extra qubits that you want to be clean and flip the first qubit if they're not all 0. And then at the end, you throw away the result if the first qubit has been flipped.
Okay, so now we can describe the one clean qubit algorithm for approximating the Jones polynomial. which basically uses this trace estimation trick. So the braid group representation acts on some vector space, and you want to make a correspondence between that vector space and the Hilbert space of your qubits. And you can't just pick any old correspondence, because you need some local structure. You can't just simulate any arbitrary unitary using an efficient quantum circuit. So to really explain this, I have to tell you a little bit more about what the particular representation of the braid group is that we're using. And so this is the one for t equals minus e to the I3 pi over 5. It's a special case of the Jones representation, which at least we call the Fibonacci representation, and which has some extra structure that makes it a little handier to deal with. So what I'll describe next you can think of as just a formal procedure by which to obtain the this representation. It comes from an area of mathematics which I don't particularly understand myself, but you can just follow these certain rules and you can get the Fibonacci representation of the braid group. So the basic the rules that you use to obtain this representation can be thought of diagrammatically, and the kind of diagrams that you draw are ones where across the bottom of a braid you put a symbol at each spot in between each pair of strands and also beyond the edges. And the types of symbols you have are P and star symbols, and there's the requirement that no stars can be adjacent to each other, but otherwise any string is allowed. So you have a series of rules. This is one example of one. And they have a local structure. So you can zoom in on this diagram and look at just one crossing across the bottom. And what you do is you undo this crossing, and you take it to a linear combination of the uncrossed strands with different bit strings, symbol strings across here. The only one that can be changed is the one that's right underneath the strand. And these coefficients here are just complex numbers that depend on your parameter t in some way. So what you do is you're given a diagram like this. You apply one of these rules. So now, say you've applied it here. Now you have a linear combination of two diagrams, both of which have removed this crossing and which have different coefficients and different values of this symbol right here. In this particular case, you can't flip the symbol. It will just apply a phase. But if where symbol crossings are allowed, you'll get the other ones. Okay. So, and you just keep applying this process using your list of rules until you have eliminated all the strands. And now you have a big superposition over the all straight lines braid with all different symbol strings across the bottom and all different coefficients. And that
particular example braid.
Yes.
If you try to open the ones associated, the crossings associated with p's, you only have one option, right?
Well, for this particular symbol string across here, this can only turn into a p. This can only turn into a p. So this particular column of the corresponding matrix is going to look kind of boring, at least if you ignore these strands up here, these crossings up there.
If you then if you do the ones at the top, I guess I'm saying, so it certainly depends on what order you do this, what you're going to get, but it's somehow supposed to be equivalent in the end? So the point is that...
Well, yes, because the crossings are non-commutative. The braid group is a non-abelian group, so it doesn't matter whether a crossing here is below this crossing. When you're applying these rules, you apply them from bottom to top.
Yeah, So the crossings are not commutative, but the thing that you're getting at the end is still just a polynomial.
Yeah. Well, in this case, it's a complex number because the polynomial evaluated at t equals minus t to the I 3 pi.
Okay, fine. So, and that has to be the same no matter what order you choose to open these, right?
No, you have to apply the rules in the order that the crossings are in the braid.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
And there's ambiguity, like you could do the one on the left before the one on the right, that can't matter?
That doesn't matter because of that relation sigma I, sigma j equals sigma j, sigma I for I minus j, difference bigger than 2. Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
And then for all possible strings, you untie the braid.
Yep.
Keep track of the superpositions.
Yep. So this gives you a linear transformation on strings. So you write in one particular string here, and you get one column of the matrix for your representation. So here's actually a complete example, just to illustrate. And so, of course, you only need to find the representation of the elementary crossings, because anything else you could just do by multiplying the matrices. And the main thing to notice from this slide is that this is a reducible representation. It can be block diagonalized, and you can actually see what the blocks correspond to. They correspond to the different possible values of the first and last symbol, because if you look at the rules, you see that only the symbols underneath a crossing get changed. So these two always stay the same. So you have one block for the ones that start and end with P, one block with for the ones that start and end with star, and the P star block and the star P block. Okay. So in light of Halloween, I have a trick and a treat. So here is the the first idea that you probably think of when you find out about this representation, and given that you know about one clean qubit. So you think, okay, just map the symbol string directly to a bit string. Each star becomes a 1, each P becomes a 0. The problem with this is that the trace estimation is over all 2 to the n bit strings, but the set of possible symbol strings is only an exponentially small fraction of that. So this does not work with one clean qubit. And this idea can trick you into thinking that this is trivial, but it's actually not. So now instead we'll have a treat. So this is a bijective correspondence between these symbol strings and integers from 0 to however many symbol strings of that length there are. And all you do is you just write the Fibonacci numbers across above each symbol, and every place there's a star, you correspondingly add up. So if it was placed value, you just put the powers of 10 or whatever here, and you'd add up. But in this case, it's the Fibonacci numbers, and so here, in this example, it's 6. Yes. Well, actually, you'll only need a constant number of clean qubits. Okay, and you can just look at some examples and see that this is true, and it's also not hard to prove that this works. So now what we're going to do to make a correspondence between symbol strings and bit strings, we're just going to take these integers, represent them in binary place value as bit strings. So, you know, you take whatever, however many this maximum integer is, round it up to the nearest power of 2. And so it'll turn out that these valid symbol strings correspond to at least half of all the bit strings that you're tracing over. So now I can actually,
from the number efficiently, you can compute the star P representation. I mean, I guess you take the Fibonacci number that.
Yeah, you do it by successive subtraction of Fibonacci numbers. Mm-hmm. And okay, so now I can actually give an outline of this algorithm. So you an elementary crossing for the braid corresponds to a unitary, which transforms only the symbols that are nearby to that crossing. So on a DQ in a one-plane qubit computer, you can think of it as you keep getting given these random bit strings. And by this representation we showed, most of these bit strings correspond to some symbol string of P and star symbols. So what you want to do, or what we decided to do, was to reversibly extract the relevant three symbols into an ancilla register of clean qubits, then perform the unitary on them, and then reversibly bring that information back into the main register. And you do that repeatedly once for each elementary crossing. So we need some tools to perform these reversible circuits. The basic question is, what reversible circuits can you do with only a constant number or also a logarithmic number of clean qubits? But actually, there's a lot you can do with only a constant number. And this is a neat consequence of Barrington's theorem, which says that, this is not the language it was originally stated in, but one consequence is that any problem in NC1, which is logarithmic depth classical circuits, can be done using only a five-dimensional ancilla space. And all the standard arithmetic operations, such as addition, subtraction, multiplication, and so on, and all the comparisons greater than, less than, equal to, can all be done in NC1. So now we can construct these reversible circuits to extract and put back this data. So suppose we want to extract the leftmost symbol of our symbol string. Well, this is not too hard, because you can show, it turns out, that the Zeckendorf representation of a given symbol string is greater than a certain threshold if and only if the first symbol is star. Yeah. You can think of it that way. I mean, what you want is a reversible circuit which extracts, looks at this Zeckendorf representation integer and extracts three symbols from it into an ancilla register, and you want that reversible circuit to not use more than logarithmically many ancillas. And it just happens that NC1 circuits can all be done without using more than a constant number of ancillas. So this fact is basically analogous to, say, you're writing down numbers in base 10. The number is only going to be greater than 100 if the third digit is non-zero, for example. That's if you have three digit numbers. So now what you do is you flip an ancilla to one, which say represents star, if the number is bigger than this, and you can do the comparison using an NC1 circuit. Then you subtract that number from the top register if your bottom register is one. So that takes care of getting the first symbol in the string, but what if you need to extract an arbitrary one? It's not necessarily as easy. But actually, you can kind of reduce this to the case of extracting the leftmost symbol. And the reason is, let's say instead of taking the whole symbol string and representing it using the Zeckendorf representation into one integer, you just chop it somewhere. Conceptually, think of it as two strings next to each other and represent each one by its own integer using the same representation. So you could think of the original Zeckendorf as being the chop is all the way past the end. So now let's say you want to move this chop to one space further. So all you have to do is extract the leftmost symbol from here, which we know how to do, and then add it into here, which we also know how to do. We can do these with NC1 circuits with not too many ancillas, and just keep moving this to where you want, and now until the leftmost symbol of one of these things is the symbol you want to extract. So that actually completes the algorithm, because now we know how to extract three symbols. We can perform our 3-qubit unitary just by solving Kataev just general universality, and then we can put it back, and then we can do that once for each crossing until we're done, and that's our whole circuit. The trace of that is the Jones polynomial of the trace closure of the braid. The errors come in because you're taking the normalized trace of the quantum circuit, and you're getting that with polynomial accuracy. So that's the source of the error, and that's why it scales exponentially with the number of strands. When you get the normalized trace, it's normalized by 1 over 2 to the n, and that 1 over 2 to the n ends up being an exponential factor between the natural normalization of the Jones polynomial and what you get. So that describes the algorithm, and then besides that, you can also consider the hardness proof, but maybe considering the time, I should. Do you want to briefly hear the hardness, or? Okay, all right. So the essence of the hardness proof is now to reduce the problem of simulating a 1-clean-qubit computer to the problem of trace estimation of a quantum circuit. So we again need some correspondence between these symbol strings of p's and stars and bit strings. But this time we don't need it to be bijective. We're actually going to use a many-to-one encoding. Many symbol strings correspond to the same bit string. The key is that this number, many, has to be the same for each bit string. The reason for that is you need the trace to be evenly weighted. If you had, a million symbol strings corresponding to one bit string and 1,000 symbol strings corresponding to the other bit string, then when you traced over all the symbol strings, you would not get the uniform weighting for all the symbol strings bit strings in your trace. So in this case, the encoding we'll use will divide the symbol string into groups of 3, and we're going to make the correspondence that the string PPP represents a bit 0, and the string P star P represents a 1. Now, this is not, of course, an exhaustive list of all the possibilities of 3 symbols. The other ones are just non-coding blocks. And roughly speaking, the reason we picked these 2 particular symbol strings is because they have P's on the edge. And you know that whereas a star cannot be next to another star, a P can be next to anything. And this is what gives us this correct even weighting for all the bit strings. Because say you have some string that encodes a 1 at a certain spot, there's correspondingly a string that encodes a 0 at the same spot by just flipping that P to a star in the middle, and vice versa. So the number of bit strings that corresponds to any given, the number of symbol strings that corresponds to any given bit string is always the same, because the data is sort of protected by these 2 P's that sandwich it. So now we're going to consider blocks of logarithmically many such groups of 3. And each of these logarithmic sized blocks is only going to encode 1 bit. So the way we decide that is we look at the groups of 3 within a block, and we keep going along until we hit one, which is one of these 2 coding strings of 3. So in this case, it will be, this is the first coding group, and it encodes a 1. And the idea is that we make these blocks logarithmically large so that on a randomly selected symbol string, the probability that any of the blocks have no coding groups in the entire block is polynomially small. So now we can describe how to reduce the simulation of a one clean qubit computer to this Jones problem. So what you want to do is construct a braid whose Fibonacci representation linearly transforms the encoded bit string the same way that your original quantum circuit linearly transforms its Hilbert space. So in that case, if you succeed in this, then the Jones polynomial for the trace closure of the braid will equal the trace of the quantum circuit, and then you're done. So if you just have a limited number of symbols to act on, you can just sort of use generic Solovay-Katayev type tools, and which basically say that if your braid group is dense on the corresponding unitary group, your representation of the braid group is dense on the corresponding unitary group, then you can simulate an arbitrary unitary on this small dimensional space. So to apply this, we need density. And recall that this representation of the braid group is reducible. So we have blocks corresponding to the outermost symbols, whether they're star P, P star, P, P, or star, star. And the star P, P star, and star, star blocks are all dense, but the P, P block is not. And this is an inconvenience which requires some tricks to get around. So what we have now is we can efficiently perform an arbitrary unitary on a string of logarithmically many symbols as long as we have a star in a known location at the edge of this region that we want to do something to. So we have to bring a star to where we need it to simulate a given gate. And this is what I just said. And so the trick we're going to use for this is something that we call the inchworm. And the basic idea is, using the same kind of encoded control knot kind of trick, you can guarantee that you have two stars at the beginning of your symbol string in known locations. Basically, the matrix elements which don't have that, you can guarantee to be zero. So now the problem is just moving these stars to where they're needed so you can perform a given encoded gate. So what you do is, since you know this star is here, you have density on logarithmically many symbols going this way. So you can use that fact to perform an arbitrary unitary. The one you choose, the one you do, is one which brings this star out furtherward. Now you know that this star is here, so you have density on logarithmically many symbols going this way. You can do an arbitrary unitary, and the one you do is the one that brings this star over to here. And so the inchworm can inch its way down to any place in the bit string that you need it. And once you have a star here, then you can use your Solovay-Katayev type of construction to simulate your gate on the encoded bit or pair of encoded bits that are neighboring to here. So that completes the sketch of the hardness proof. And so to summarize, one clean qubits can efficiently estimate the Jones polynomial at a fifth root of unity of the trace closure of braids. And any problem solvable in a one clean qubit computer is reducible to this. So if indeed DQC1 is not contained in P, which is generally believed, then this is an exponential speed up over classical computation using a one clean qubit computer. And I think this is especially interesting because one clean qubit computers are potentially easier to build than full blown quantum computers. So I think there are many interesting ways in which this could be generalized. So first of all, this is for the fifth root of unity. And analogously, the first BQP completeness results for Jones polynomials were also done at the fifth root of unity. But it was subsequently shown that you could extend these to t equals e to the I, other roots of unity beyond 5. So you could try to do this also for the one clean qubit case. I suspect it's probably true that it still can be solved on a one clean qubit computer if you go to other k besides 5. There are also more general polynomials you could approximate. And one of the really exciting things, I think, about the whole topic of Jones polynomials in quantum computation is that they provide a whole new source of exponential speedups beyond the hidden subgroup stuff. And in fact, this class of algorithms is getting pretty large. Now it's now known that you can solve the Tutte polynomial, approximate the Tutte polynomial on a quantum computer. And as special cases, this includes all kinds of interesting things, including other knot invariants, and also things such as the partition function of the Potts model. So you could also ask whether there's some approximation of these more general polynomials that you can approximate on a one-clean qubit computer. And you could also look, well, we now have complete Jones polynomial problems for two quantum complexity classes, BQP and DQC1. I think it would be really beautiful if you could find analogously complete Jones problems for other quantum complexity classes. Another question that I've been asked now more than once is, what are the hard instances? And these must be ones where the Jones polynomial is large, that the representation of this braid group has a large trace. But it would be nice to have maybe a more topological or at least more helpful in some way characterization of that. And of course, there's the question of how to actually implement a one clean qubit computer, which is also very interesting. Thanks.
Could I just repeat what you just said? You said, talking about hard instances, sort of that problem is hard when the value of the Jones polynomial is large.
Yes, because
the opposite.
Because if the value of the Jones polynomial is small, then this error interval will include zero, and you can just guess zero every time. And that's as good. And so for the problems the way that they're stated here, those instances would not be hard. Because of the...
So the way I see this relationship is, you are mapping sort of the value of the Jones polynomial to the expectation value of a certain observable, say the expectation value of the Pauli observable sigma z.
Yeah.
And that involves a normalization factor. So, I mean, in principle, the value of the Jones polynomial can be very large. It's now squeezed into this region between plus and minus 1, and or say between 0 and 1, for that matter. And, well, so the now of this rescaling, I mean, the maximum value of the Jones polynomial could be 1, but the average value will be very, very, very small. So I need to repeat the experiment very, very often to actually get some significant digits. So I would say if the value of the Jones polynomial is large, i.e. then sort of a significant fraction of 1 of the rescaling, I would need to measure less of.
I guess it depends on what notion of hardness you have. Like, so if you're saying if you're defining the problem as the problem of approximating the Jones polynomial with this particular factor, and that you say, okay, that's my definition and that's it, what I said I think is true, that if the Jones polynomial is small, then you just have to guess zero. If your question is, let's get a meaningful approximation of the Jones polynomial that tells us something about what its value is, then the smaller instances, I guess, are harder because you need to your additive approximation to be tighter. So I think it's
question you've been looking at. So you are really into this.
Yeah, I mean, you could say like let's say factoring. So how do you what if you reduce factoring to an instance of Jones polynomial? What would it look like? It must be one that has a large value of the Jones polynomial because otherwise.
What you're saying is if for all the instances where the Jones polynomial is small, you could guess zero in that one, and then you wouldn't have to bother doing the computation. But any number, let's renormalize this all to between plus and minus one. Right? For any number, I mean, I could guess 0.76, and there would be a set of instances that would be close to that, and I'd say, well, these are all easy because I could just guess 0.76. I don't think there's anything special about zero here.
It's a bit disingenuous to say that it has to be large. It's just that the range of possibilities has to include large numbers, right? So if you're doing a quantum circuit and the answer is always zero, then that might tell you something. But a priori, you know, for this language that you were thinking about, it had to include some cases where it wasn't always zero, or there wouldn't be any, and it would be a very trivial language.
Right. I mean, the hard instances are...
Yeah. Well, I suspect for random instances, the value will be small enough that you can guess zero every time. I guess that's maybe what I had in mind. Because, I mean, if you imagine some random unitary, its trace is going to be very small compared to the trace of the identity.
So if you had to guess without doing computation, your best guess would be zero, and that would cover the largest number of cases.
Right, like you're building this thing.
Yeah, it's a random break.
I don't even think you can put a measure of it.
Yes, to make what I said precise might be difficult, but yes, well, so this would be things you can compute using Clifford circuits. So I haven't thought very carefully about the complexity issues, but I had a reasons to suspect that at t equals I, the representation of the Bragg group might lie within the Clifford group. I'm not sure if this is true yet.
But non-universal Einstein models look at think to the Clifford group.
Okay.
Five halves.
That's exactly the Clifford group, or is it just a subset?
I think it's exactly the Clifford group.
Well, that would astonish me. But Sir Gabriel Lee has a paper on using the five halves for topological quantum computation.
Right.
And he needs two Ansible states, one sort of a magic state distillation and one to do an entangling gate.
Oh, okay, so maybe it's not. Okay.
So what? How is DQC1 related, and what's the best upper bound on for DQC1?
I think the best upper bound is that it's contained in BQP. As far as I know, I don't think there's any stronger upper bound on it than that.
Right, an inaccuracy.
Oh,
about your conjecture on maybe the previous slide. Yes. So the last one, right? So I assume you meant really DQC1 not contained in BPP because that's randomized.
Yeah. I should have said that properly. Yes.
Well, let me keep nattering at the other complexity classes here. No, sorry, back. So the applications of the Jones polynomial in BQP and DQC1 are all related to this idea of using braids to represent line circuits.
Yeah.
That's sort of why you can use polynomials to compute things in BQP, for instance. So QMA is kind of a different beast, right?
Yeah.
Is there any reason, can you give me a plausible reason to think that these methods might give us something QMA complete?
Well, so I was first trying to think about whether there was some sufficiently high precision that trace estimation of a quantum circuit might be QMA hard. And yeah.
So that would be QMA hard.
Okay. Yeah.
It's not in QMA.
Yeah. You would want it to be QMA complete. You'd want it to be QMA complete. Yeah.